This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Chicago PD goes high tech. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Glad you could spend some time with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Borrowing a page from other big cities, Chicago authorities are trying the latest technology to slow the rise in violent crime.
On the food front, having your burger with a side of peanut butter and other items we ask for that are off menu.
As we head towards summer, thousands of kids around the country aren't allowed to apply sunscreen in school. We'll explain why.
And how to make an airline like United keep its promises.
You had a situation where 10 years went by and then finally there had to be some regulation. But I think that the airline's track record on this is not so terribly good. And there's a very good chance that they're not going to keep their promises, at least not the way that we think they're going to keep their promises.
Consumer advocate and travel expert Christopher Elliott on what United Airlines means when it says it promises to do better. He's here in about 25 minutes. Chicago police dealing with 762 homicides and over 4,000 shootings last year are turning to technology for help. Officials hope the new Strategic Decision Support Centers can help stem the surge of violence that's brought national attention to the city. You'll recall President Trump threatened to send in the feds if the city was unable to quell the bloodshed. Here's Wall Street Journal Midwest correspondent Shabani Matani. Shabani, what are we seeing?
One of the things that they've tried this year, and they've rolled out in the two most violent districts first, and they're slowly rolling out in other districts that have been contributing to the spike in crime, is that they have integrated a bunch of different technologies together. This includes ShotSpotter technology, where this technology can essentially pick up gunshots in real time. So police don't have to wait for a 911 call. They don't need to sort of have somebody guess where they heard the gunshot from. You know, it feeds directly into a technology platform that they have. They've also integrated this with a number of different other technologies that they have, including the software called HunchLab, which essentially predicts where a specific crime is going to happen next. You know, little Minority Report flashbacks there, but it has like these squares essentially that kind of update themselves three times a day and sort of like go to a specific location and tell police to go there.
Have the shots fired technology that you mentioned, is that are those ones that are picked up by microphone?
Yes, it's an acoustic sensor, and it allows police to have a very accurate sense of exactly where that shot was fired. And it's being used in many different cities across the U.S. Chicago has rolled it out completely now in the two most violent districts in the city, Englewood and the Harrison District on the west side. And they're going to be rolling it out more completely in some of the other neighborhoods that are driving crime in the city.
Wow. As I'm sure if the police officials, law enforcement, and city officials and residents want to know, what about results? Are we seeing improvements?
Yeah, so I mean, academics would always say that it's, you know, much too soon, and the fact that they've only done this in the two, you know, most violent districts, you could just be seeing those districts kind of return to the mean and sort of stabilize themselves after a really bad 2016. But yes, so far the two districts where this technology is being employed have seen about a 30%, 40% drop in shootings, and this is more than the 16% drop that that is being seen across Chicago as a whole. So yeah, I mean, it does seem like it's working. It does seem like the initial results show that there are definitely less shootings in these neighborhoods than there were last year.
We're speaking with Shabani Matani, Midwest correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Her piece is called Chicago Tries High-Tech Approach to Curb Violence. I guess an old school approach would be, hey, can we just please get some cops or detectives in the areas where this stuff is happening? Have they tried that and abandoned that, or is this in supplemental to the technology, or how does that work?
Yeah, I think the police would say that it's hand in hand, right? So this technology allows them to be more visible in the areas where violent crime is occurring. So they're able to go to the community and say, you know, listen, we know that there's going to be a robbery here or another shooting here. Or they can say, you know, you're in a high-risk neighborhood. Can you please keep in touch with us and tell us what's going on here? And ideally, you know, the strategy would work best if they marry that community aspect here with that technology, considering the relationship between minority communities and the Chicago Police Department has been really frayed since the Laquan McDonald shooting and the release of that videotape. Academics and critics do point out that this technology is fairly expensive. The whole program has cost about $6.8 million so far.
Wow.
And, you know, how is that really different from what police were doing anyway, right, which is looking at historic crime data, figuring out the neighborhoods that are more dangerous and just, you know, being much more present there without having some kind of computer telling them, oh, this neighborhood's more dangerous.
These algorithms that try to predict trouble spots, anybody complaining about civil liberties here?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a concern that the police department's not going to be as transparent as they should be in releasing what the algorithm is based on. And that's the same for the strategic subjects list as well, which is a list that the police department has put together of people who are likely either to be shot or to be a shooter themselves. They use this list to basically intercept these people or try to talk to them and try to sit them down before they get involved in a violent act. But, you know, even researchers say that they haven't got any information from the police department about what they're pulling to put together this list, right? And I think that there are a lot of concerns there that a lot of stuff could be prejudicial.
Shabani, it's Wall Street Journal Midwest correspondent Shabani Matani. 13 minutes now after the hour. On this weekend, when a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Thanks for being with us. Are smartphones helping or hurting our relationships at home and work and play? We're joined now by Dr. Greg Jantz, psychologist, author, also founder of an addiction treatment center in Seattle called A Place of Hope. Greg, how do you see this?
This really is the beginning of some real issues that we've got to figure out how to navigate, not just for ourselves, but for our kids as well.
All right, so how do you do that? How do you figure out how to navigate if you're having a problem here?
Well, I'm doing a lot right now on technology and mental health because we know an overuse of technology can increase depression. The more you spend on the social networks, the worse you feel, and it increases anxiety. That said, you've got to have, okay, what's my family or what's my home technology agreement, and we've got to get everybody aboard. You know, I have two boys. I have an eighth grader and I have a senior in high school. And my boys have rules that govern the use of technology in our home. And we actually have a place where you put your phone on the charger at a certain time at night or you don't have it the next day.
Mm.
So what's our rules? What's our boundaries? There's a lot to figure out there, but we need to keep it an open book and be talking about it. And by the way, adults are just as guilty as our kids.
Well, are they getting the example from us?
Yeah. Well, if you're walking down the hall in your house and you're texting and you run into the wall and you tell your kid he's on the phone too much, that might be a problem.
We're speaking with Dr. Greg Jantz, psychologist, also founder of a place called A Place of Hope. It's an addiction treatment center in Seattle. We're talking about whether or not smartphones are helping or hurting our anxiety. Some who have put together these apps, right, that put you in touch with psychologists or psychiatrists to help deal with this stuff, though, I guess might say that smartphones have opened somewhat of a different door maybe for help.
You know, I would say it puts a connection with somebody we trust. So if you're receiving some help and as a way of, and we do this too, as a way of follow up and a way to keep that already connection going, but it's just one piece of that pie. So I've got that. I can use that as a communication. It's nice to communicate, hey, I'm in trouble, I'm not doing well, or I'm doing good, and reporting back on maybe homework. But when I need help, I need to talk with a human being at some point. So it's a step in between that can have some limited help.
All right. You mentioned before that spending too much time on social media makes us feel worse. Why is that?
Yes. You know, here's the thing. We're looking for connection. We're looking for to feel better. So what we know and what surveys have shown and what we are seeing here is that the more you're already depressed and you go out there and I'm just online all the time and I'm Facebooking and I'm just in the social media, I end up feeling less connected versus more connected because probably I have some artificial relationships or I have some relationships that really don't represent true relationship or true intimacy, but I'm so dispersed and scattered in my relationships, I feel more disconnected.
So what's going to happen here in the coming 5-10 years when it comes to smartphones?
It's going to be really, really interesting. And what I mean by that is there's going to be a lot of good, and we need to embrace the good. And there's going to be some areas that we're going to be really, really concerned about. For example, the average age to pornography on the internet for young boys about age 9 or 10 now. So we're seeing those issues drop to lower ages. We're seeing issues like sexual addiction because most of it's being accessed through the mobile apps with our kids starting at younger ages. So, you know, there is a dark side, and we've got to be addressing that as well as there's a really good side, too.
When we talk about ages like that, what's a parent to do?
Well, the best thing a parent can do is you've got to engage in their world, talk about it so that we're not hiding it, and we don't want to shame a kid. So one of the things we do, and here's a quick suggestion, once a week, do have dinner together the best you can, and have a digital dinner. It's the one time, pick a day of the week, that if you have kids, that they can talk about anything in their digital world, and you sit there and ask them questions about it. It'll be an opportunity for you to learn about what's going on in their life. And we have a couple different rules. You know, when you're with somebody, be with them. If you're at lunch with somebody and they're texting and they look up at you and they say, "What'd you say?" You know, it's disconnection. And so what we want to do is our rule is be together when you're with somebody. If you have something you want to show me on your smartphone, well, ask to show it, but don't make that the centerpiece of a mealtime.
Thanks, Greg. Dr. Greg Jantz, psychologist, author, and founder of an addiction treatment center called A Place of Hope. It's located in Seattle. 21 minutes now after the hour. On this weekend, time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. For some restaurant customers, the hottest items aren't on the menu. They want customized creations cooked up online, like chicken cordon bleu McMuffins or puppuccino. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
How about a peanut butter bacon burger or a butter beer frappuccino? These may not be on the menu, but you can get them anyway. Corinne Ramey of the Wall Street Journal joins us now to talk about a new food ordering trend. Corinne, how did these customized creations get started?
Well, I think we really have to give some credit to the internet and social media for a lot of these. Most of these get started either from customers making up their own customized creations or restaurant employees just kind of messing around on their breaks and seeing what they can cook up. And some of them seem to hit social media and go viral and really stick.
So someone posts a picture of something and then somebody else copies it? Is that how it works?
Essentially, yes. We particularly see this on Instagram. And there's also some websites out there that essentially act sort of like recipe books that they chronicle some of these, quote, secret menu items and list exactly how to order them and what they believe the recipe is.
Corinne, in researching your story, what are some of the weirder things you saw?
I have to say one of my absolute favorites is the puppuccino, which is not weird or complicated, but it's really just an espresso cup at Starbucks with whipped cream in it, and it's for dogs.
How did that get started?
Honestly, I don't know how that one got started. Customers and Starbucks seem to be widely aware of it. And I asked a friend of mine who's a barista, who also said that she gets puppuccino orders on a daily basis, even though it's not on the menu.
So how do chains handle this? Somebody comes in and asks for something wacky. Do they all agree to do it?
It's tricky for chains. Some of them say, like, In-N-Out have really embraced it. They supposedly train their employees in their secret menu items. They post them on their website. They're not exactly secret at the end of the day. Others, like, say, Starbucks, will say they can basically customize anything that a customer wants, but you have to bring them the exact menu, the exact recipe. Say, I want two pumps of this and one pump of that. But yet for others, it's a little tricky. They'll, if, especially if staff are busy, they don't want to take time to make some custom sandwich.
We are speaking with Corinne Ramey of the Wall Street Journal. What is this hackthemenu.com site?
So that is one of the sites I mentioned that essentially lists recipes that the guy who runs hackthemenu.com has chronicled this for a couple years. He gets recommendations from people who work at these chains and also from customers sort of saying that this is the next top thing. This is the next secret menu item.
Now, if it's not a secret anymore, does that kind of kill the whole idea?
Well, kind of. I mean, if I think being a secret is part of the fun of the whole thing, that when restaurants embrace these and if they either put them on the menu or sometimes even just add official pricing, they tend to become less exciting for consumers.
Now, do you think that some of these chains are going to be not so happy about your story that's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal?
I'm a little afraid Starbucks may get extra orders for puppuccinos.
Now, if you actually wanted to do this, you wanted to create something, how would you go about going into a restaurant and asking for it?
Well, so I had some people in the story told me some tips. They suggested that, you know, you have to be really nice when you ask. You have to know what you're asking for. Don't just ask for the name of something. Know the exact ingredients. And bring the recipe, like, written down with you.
Thanks. That's Corinne Ramey of the Wall Street Journal with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Ready for hundreds of millions of potential new customers? Come to a two-day conference in Detroit in June to hear about Alibaba, the Chinese version of what's described as Amazon plus Google. Today, China represents an unprecedented opportunity for American business owners and entrepreneurs. Alibaba, an e-commerce platform, can connect you with 500 million consumers. You can buy and sell anything. Learn more about the worldwide marketplace of Alibaba at Gateway 17, June 20th to the 22nd. Meet experts, make relationships, and learn from companies already in China. You'll also hear Jack Ma, the ultimate entrepreneur and China expert. Gateway 17 has limited availability, but our listeners can save 50% off the registration fee by going to gateway17.com and using the code DEAL when you register. That's gateway17.com, GATEWAY17.com, and enter DEAL. 50% off the registration fee, but only if you use DEAL when you sign up at gateway17.com. Thanks for being with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, three costly Social Security surprises to be aware of. The argument by some that car infotainment systems have gotten too fancy and where kids can't apply sunblock at school. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, complaining about United Airlines has become a hobby for air travelers. It ranked number 2 for total passenger complaints behind troubled American Airlines. The top grievances: flight problems, baggage issues, customer service. United Airlines now pledges new protections for flyers in wake of the passenger dragging incident. But how can we hold them to those promises? Here's consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. Chris, set this up.
By way of background, we had the David Dow dragging incident where he was dragged off the plane, and that a video was taken of that went viral. You remember that. And then after that, there were congressional hearings. And Oscar Munoz went into Congress and said, hey, we're going to do better. Give us a chance. And the head of that committee, of the Transportation Committee, said, okay, you had your chance, but, you know, this is your last warning. Next time we're going to do something along the lines of regulation. So So the airline industry knows that it's got to do better. The question is, though, what is its track record? And if you go back to, I mean, just go back to 1999 when we had that incident on the tarmac with Northwest Airlines, where they were holding people in a blizzard, I think it was Minneapolis, on the tarmac for 12 hours. And they said that they were going to do better after that. They weren't going to keep people on the tarmac for that long. And it took, and it never happened. So you had a situation where 10 years went by, and then finally there had to be some regulation. So I think that the airline's track record on this is not so terribly good. And there's a very good chance that they're not going to keep their promises, at least not the way that we think they're going to keep their promises.
Right, right. So you alluded to it a little bit, but sometimes, I mean, I think the airlines operate out of fear, right, that if they don't do something, Congress will step in and throw a regulation at them or something.
Yeah, maybe in 10 years or so, Congress will do something, but they've got some time. And so I think what they're doing is they've made some promises, and I think that they made promises that they have no intention of keeping, at least not the way we think they're going to keep them. And so now it's really a question of what is Congress going to do and when.
We're speaking with consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. He's written an interesting piece entitled How to Make United Airlines Keep Its Promises. And he knows this stuff pretty well. He's written a book called How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. You mentioned, too, I thought it was interesting, these three places where airlines hide their promises. And one of them you mentioned is in a corporate mission statement or vision statement. And sometimes you as a consumer, if done correctly, can use that against them.
Absolutely. Well, even though maybe they're not going to keep their promises on an institutional level, they can on an individual level. And so when I see cases coming through my consumer advocacy site and we try to help them, what we see is that if you remind a company that they've made a promise in writing somewhere, that often is enough to persuade them to do the right thing. And a mission statement is a really good example. As you mentioned, every company, this is not just for airlines, they have a mission statement. And they normally say, you know, we endeavor to be the best company for transportation. We treat everyone fairly and with dignity and all that. And you can read these. They're very entertaining. And if you can remind them that they've made that kind of a statement, then sometimes that's going to do the trick for you, and you can get them to issue a refund or an apology or something like that. I have seen that happen.
Thanks, Chris. That's consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. It's 22 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Even if your retirement is years away, it's a good idea to periodically check in on your Social Security benefits. Why? To make sure your earnings record is accurate. That can be a nasty surprise. Kelly Grant at CNBC.com says, left uncorrected, an error could cost you thousands of dollars in retirement. Kelly, what do we have?
Well, we know that a lot of people count on their Social Security check for a good portion of their income. It's about half of married couples and almost three-quarters of unmarried folks. For them, that check is at least half of their income. So it's important as you're planning ahead for this to make sure that you're making decisions that aren't going to, you know, ultimately result in a lower payment for you.
All right. So explain what kind of surprises we could encounter here.
Well, one of the first ones is if your record is incorrect. We know now Social Security Administration is starting to add in extra protections for folks who want to go online and check their records. Makes it a little harder to log in. You'll need not just your login info, but it's an extra code via something they call two-factor authentication. But it's a good idea to set that up and then keep monitoring your account online to make sure that all of your records are up to date. If there is a problem with that or they have inaccurate information, that's ultimately going to affect what sort of a payment you get when you eventually retire.
All right. So you point out here something important if you're divorced. What's this? There's still reason to love your ex, meaning what?
Yes. If you are divorced, under certain circumstances, you may be able to collect an amount basically based on your ex's work record. So depending on, you know, your own work record, if you had, you know, periods where maybe you didn't have as high of an income or maybe you were out of the workforce if you were caring for children, the payment that you're entitled to under your ex's work record could actually be more than your own. So if you are divorced and not currently married, you would want to be kind of paying attention to that as a claiming strategy as you're looking ahead to your Social Security options. You know, it's not necessarily something you're going to see in the paperwork, but it's something that you can ask about. And, you know, just to be aware of that, it might actually get you a little more money.
You point out, too, number two, where you retire matters.
There are different state laws that will influence, just how friendly the taxes are in retirement. And most states actually are pretty tax friendly that they do not tax Social Security checks. But there are a handful. It's roughly a baker's dozen that do have some sort of taxation on Social Security benefits. In some cases, that's waived based on income. But if you were really counting on that check, it might be something that you would want to think about.
Mm. We're speaking with Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com, also a certified financial planner. Her piece is called Three Social Security Surprises That May Leave Money on the Table. Number three, you say procrastination can be costly. How so?
Well, usually when we talk about Social Security timing, there's that big debate of do you claim early, do you claim late, do you claim at your full retirement age? There's a lot of timing issues on that we could talk for a couple of hours on that front. But one of the timing gaps that people tend to forget about is that you need to file to apply to receive your benefits usually roughly 3 months before you actually want to receive that first payment. And that can be an income gap for people that they're not prepared for if they're filing too late. You know, maybe there's a month or two in there where you really could have used that check, but you have to come up with some other financial options instead.
Thanks, Kelly. Kelly Grant, CNBC.com. It's 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. It's Small Business Month, and Dell is celebrating innovators and job creators in a big way, like up to 40% off business PCs big. Even a free 1 terabyte external hard drive with select purchases big. Call 877-BUY-DELL today to connect with a U.S.-based advisor. They're ready to help with tech solutions tailored to your business, like finding just the right Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, because your hard work is more than appreciated, it's admired. Call 877-BUY-DELL today. Hey, thanks for being with us. Automakers have come to rely on car tech for a disproportionate amount of profit as they load up their vehicles with gizmos and gadgets. However, they're leaving some drivers dazed and confused, even driving them to attend two-hour demonstration seminars. What's wrong with that picture? Here's Wall Street Journal automotive reporter Christina Rogers in Detroit. Christina, what have you found?
Well, I mean, we talked to a lot of car owners who basically were either puzzled by the technology in their cars or simply were having trouble with it. I mean, a lot of the software can be pretty buggy, and it's very new, so a lot of these car makers are just starting to roll it out. And so we talked to a bunch of car owners and about their headaches, basically.
Are these car owners young and old?
Oh, yes. I mean, that was one thing that really surprised me. It didn't seem to matter your age.
Wow.
I mean, clearly, you know, we did hear a lot from older car owners who were just kind of baffled by their tech. But, you know, I talked to some millennials as well who said that, you know, it's too complicated for me to use. I'm not interested in it. You know what? My car is just for transportation. I don't need all the bells and whistles. I have all the tech I need in my phone, and that's enough for me. So I mean, I don't think this kind of headache is limited to one age group.
And part of the issue is that many of these cars are already outfitted with it, right? It's not like you can just choose something else. Many of them show up on the lot and they have these infotainment systems already in.
Yeah, I mean, more and more so. I mean, it used to be that you would kind of, they would be offered as options, and so you'd pay, you know, a couple thousand more to get what they would call the tech package.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, I mean, the whole idea of a touch screen, I mean, that's becoming pretty common. You know, even I was talking to some automakers, and I said, well, what about the tech light version? What about those, like, stripped-down models, that have bells and whistles? And they said, yeah, you know, even today, your most basic, lower-priced trim model will have some of that. So if you're a true car Luddite, it's tough in the new car market for you.
All right, so what do you do here? Some of them offer like seminars, right, to tell you how to operate these things?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the funny part about this is that the cars are becoming so complicated that what automakers are doing and what their dealers are doing is starting to offer tutorials or even hire staffers whose job it is specifically to help. They call them product experts or technology specialists, but their job is not to sell cars. It is to help buyers become familiar with the technology in their car. You know, I talked to one Mercedes dealer who said that, you know, sometimes their sessions with customers can last 2 hours.
Oh.
I mean, those are on the very, very expensive, fully loaded, you know, kind of teched out upper end models. But I mean, they said roughly most tutorials take about a half an hour.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it just goes to show you how much tech overload there is.
So do some of these things go haywire also and completely malfunction, or is it just that they're a pain in the neck or complicated to use?
It's a little bit of both, I think. You know, it's kind of understanding the technology and then kind of the software glitches that come with it.
Thanks, Christina. Wall Street Journal automotive reporter Christina Rogers from Detroit. 7 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. You may have heard of school curriculum called Sunbeatables, designed by specialists at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. It features a cast of superheroes who teach children the basics of sun protection, including the obvious, and that's how and when to apply sunscreen. There's just one wrinkle here. The Wall Street Journal says many of the about 1,000 schools where the curriculum is taught are in states that don't allow students to bring sunscreen to school or apply it without a note from a doctor or parent and a trip to the nurse's office. Schools have restrictions because the U.S. Food and Drug Administration labels sunscreen as an over-the-counter medication. To override that, at least 7 states, including California, New York, Oregon, and Texas, have passed laws that require that schools allow students to bring in and put on sunscreen. This year, there has been a flurry of legislation. Arizona, Washington, and Utah passed bills, and legislation is pending in Rhode Island, Louisiana, Georgia, Massachusetts, Mississippi, Alabama, and Pennsylvania to allow sunscreen. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.